Okay, sir, why don't we go ahead and continue?
All right.
You had just gotten wounded or gotten the shrapnel removed from yourself.
Right, and I didn't know that that day, that same day I was hit, that Saigon was being overrun again.
Okay.
They called it the second Tet Offensive of 1968. Tansanute was shut down. I didn't know about that. All essential aircraft, and we couldn't even get a ride out of Fubai.
Mm-hmm.
One of our guys, Harry Breedlove, without me knowing about it, had also been wounded that the day before. I think he was wounded on the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was hit on the 7th of May. And we finally we sat around the runway. I was getting sore and sore,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't feeling the greatest. And I remember sitting there by a field hospital, and I'd already packed up my camera again. I was just waiting for a ride, and a Chinook came in with a bunch of badly wounded Marines, and one of the men was carrying a severed arm of someone else's with him. And I just looked at those guys, and I said, oh, my God, I wished I would have had the camera out, because it sure said a lot about war.
Right.
I was desperate, so I found out where the Air America base was,
mm-hmm.
and I found a old DC-3 that was being loaded, and I talked to one of the pilots, and he finally agreed to let us go on a flight with him back to Saigon. It was interesting sitting in this plane. It was there was some pigs, some montagnards, and some other small bales of something that smelled horrible, but I didn't ask about it. I was just happy to be on a plane and sitting there getting a ride back.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got to Saigon, I got to see from the air what I'd always seen from the ground: tracers everywhere and flares lighting up the city. And I remember the plane coming in. It really was one of the worst landings I'd ever had in my life.
Really, what happened?
The plane came down on one tire and one wing, bounced off sideways. Same thing happened on the other side, and bounced again, and, I mean, we were just skidding down the runways, and crates were flying around in the plane, and it was, I thought, oh, my God, this is it. But he pulled it out, and we landed okay. But, I mean, there was still just stuff happening everywhere, tracers going everywhere at the mm-hmm. airport. And one end of the airport, there was a French cemetery where there was a lot of fighting going on. But that's where all the, I think that's where most of the action was coming from.
Was this at night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I still had to get back to the villa, and we got through to the villa, and they sent a team out to get us, and they were escorted by the White Mice, what they called the Vietnamese police.
Mm-hmm.
And after we left that airbase, the streets were deserted, but you could hear occasional gunfire, and there was another curfew out, and nothing happened on the way back to the villa.
Mm-hmm.
Next day, we did our captions, and those things were getting set off to the States, and that was used by NBC Nightly News, that footage.
Okay.
And I had a report to a field hospital near our villa in Saigon, and the next day, or it was that day, I guess, when I reported to the field hospital, Captain Rick Griffith was shot in the arm,
mm-hmm.
and my friend Brian Grigsby jumped out. Well, Griffith was under fire, and Griffith had been knocked over by when he got hit. And Brian laid his camera gear down and his recorder down and ran out and pulled Griffith out of harm's way while being shot at.
Mm.
And Brian won a Silver Star for that.
Wow.
And I guess that was the last offensive of that year that I knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I went back to Hawaii on May 16th of 1968.
Okay.
The commercial press, I mean, we were just doing our job. That's all we did. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this was our job. And the commercial press, those guys made a living by, trying to be the bravest and get the story out the first. And sometimes they even trampled over each other getting stories. I remember when I was at Quezon, it was just a madhouse with these with the commercial press just mm-hmm. running over each other, and they were I was quite amazed at how pushy they could be, and of course we were at the bottom of the food chain in their opinion.
Why did they think that, do you think?
Oh, I think we were just army grunts to them then.
Okay.
We weren't quote-unquote part of the press. And later, I know we've talked to a lot of them, and they didn't feel that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, later on, they said, we always wondered what happened to you guys and what you guys did, and, mm-hmm. you know. But at that time, I to get a story and to be the first one to shove a microphone into somebody's face, it was pretty amazing to watch.
How did you guys get along in the field? I mean, were they...
Oh, fine. No, there was no... When we were out in the field, we usually stayed in a public information area. If there was some battle going on, before we could get out to... Oh, like in Fubai, for example, there was a PIO office.
Mm-hmm.
And before you could get out to Camp Carroll or out to some of the other areas, you might end up spending the night at the quarters there at the PIO office.
Mm-hmm.
And we often went out for, you know, beers and chatted about what was going on. And mm-hmm. sometimes if it was a big battle, going into Ashaw, there could be 20, 30 people there.
Hmm.
Just depended on what was happening and where you were at that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of any specific reporters?
The only ones I mentioned to you before, Sean Flynn,
mm-hmm.
who was a cameraman, a freelance cameraman. He was a real decent guy. I'm trying to think who else. There was one fellow that was on. That was the morning anchor for CBS. I can't remember his name. He still does work for CBS. Really a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And talked to him quite a few times. And I guess that... And I also talked to... There were some Korean reporters that were interesting to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the Koreans had sent the rocks over.
Right.
And, just talking to them. And it was interesting, but I think basically we got along pretty well with them. But we were still, I think, overall, just because of the way that the barrages that I got involved with, where they were trying to get a story. I mean, they didn't care who they ran over,
mm-hmm.
including themselves. I mean, it just was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you find, the field commanders, when you guys were out in the field together, showed any preference toward DASPO and the military press versus the civilian press?
It was funny. Yes, sometimes they did.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we got better treatment than them, but most of the time they were treated better than us.
Okay.
I mean, these guys wanted their names put out in front of a lot of people, and that's how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of guys just, you know, they knew we were out there working just like they were, and we got some preferential treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It just depended on the field commander.
Okay.
I was I sure was glad to get back to Hawaii though after that trip.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty eventful first time in Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw one job really that wasn't a combat operation of some type that
mm-hmm.
time. Everything else was a combat op. I was very, very pleased to get that behind me and leave there.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I was going to come back at least for one more tour before my days in DASPO was over, and I wasn't even looking forward to that already.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was good to go back to Hawaii. It was really expensive there. I mean, I made about $150 a month,
mm-hmm.
and I just bought an old 1953 MG, and the payments were about $50 plus the insurance a month.
Okay.
And I lived in a barracks, and I think before we left, there was a number of us that were trying to find an apartment, but we stayed in the barracks and did more training or trained other people and looked at captions. And while we were there, President Johnson and President Tu had a conference there about the war, and we had a huge. Of course, we had probably about 20 guys back, and we covered that very thoroughly. I think I mentioned to you the difference between a blimped camera and a non-blimped camera.
Yes, sir.
Well, they gave me a non-blimped Airy, a 35 millimeter Airy, and I mean I was way up in the balcony just shooting cutaways, and when that thing went on, everybody in the whole audience, when they was given their press conferences, turned around. It was awful. I mean, I turned it on and just almost walked away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I was very embarrassed. Well, that seemed to be over with in a quick hurry living back in Hawaii, but I got a great assignment. My third TDOY was with a small team, and the officer in charge of that was a guy named Bill San Hamill. He was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
There was another fellow by the name of Chuck Abbott and Tom Larson and myself. Abbott and I shot the motion, and Larson did stills.
Okay.
I think if we did some sound, we just probably took turns doing sound and getting some wild sound, meaning non-sync stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were civilian status on that whole job. It was great.
Where was it?
I'll get into it. We flew commercial, and we had these huge weight restrictions on our baggage because we were flying commercial. We took a ton of equipment and film with us, and we were focused on three subjects. We left Hawaii on the 3rd of August in 1968, and I think we arrived in Taipei, Taiwan, on the 5th of August. The first production was how the Taiwan government manufactured 2.5-ton trucks for the military use in Vietnam.
Okay.
They just assembled trucks from components that we shipped over.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent about 2 weeks covering that story.
Okay.
We stayed in Taipei and took taxis each day across to the port city, which was on the other side of the island, but it didn't take us for maybe an hour to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you, that was an interesting country. Every inch of that country seemed to be cultivated. Up the sides of the mountains and rice paddies. I remember the city, though, being a gray, kind of a gloomy-looking city at the time without any very, very attractive buildings.
Mm-hmm.
It was I think it was built for expediency and not for any aesthetic values.
Where did you all stay in Taiwan?
We stayed in a hotel downtown, and
okay.
We would I'd go down to the Navy's Officers Club with Bill a lot. He and I got along very, very well. We maintained close contact. We speak to each other a few times each year. Second part of the trip was involved us capturing a story on ammunition renovation and fuel storage facilities.
Okay.
And our next stop was Okinawa. And that was an interesting story. We met the base commander, and he was a full colonel, and he directed Bill to stay in the officers' quarters and us to stay in the EM billets. And Bill said to the colonel, he said, look, I'd like to know if there's a good hotel that we could stay in Kadena and work out of. The colonel just went nuts. There was another colonel, full colonel in the room as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill said to him, he says, look, he says, we're authorized to stay in civilian hotels, and it would be better for the team if we did so.
Mm-hmm.
So this colonel said, let me see your orders. And the colonel read them over and handed them to the other colonel. He said, I've never seen anything like this before. He said, these men are authorized to steal. Hello?
I'm here.
Yeah, did you get the last part?
They're authorized to steal?
Yeah, he said, these men are authorized to steal. Because he's never seen anything quite like our orders.
Okay, so he thought that you all were basically had it easy.
No. I think he thought that we when he said that. He said he was being sarcastic when he said it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in other words, he'd never seen orders like that before.
Okay. I
mean, he said, we're authorized to do just about anything we want to, in other words.
Right. You had run of the place.
Pardon me?
You had a run of the place,
that's
basically.
Right. That's right. Uh-huh. Let's see. I remember us going a long ways away from the base, and we went to this factory. It was outside, and they were Japanese civilians working along benches and unscrewing heads of mortar shells. And, I think there were 105 shells that howitzers used. And they had to repack the shells and make sure they were up to, that they would work.
Mm-hmm.
So I never realized that, you know, that the ammunition got old. And I guess they sent this stuff back and forth every 6 months or every year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, I think I was more nervous filming around that group than anything, because I was expecting, you know, I was hoping, you know, and no electrical sparks, nobody was smoking.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of ammunition there. And then the next part of our trip took us to Japan.
Okay.
And in Japan, we were covering the same thing, ammunition renovation and fuel storage.
Okay.
We landed in Tokyo and proceeded to Yokohama, where we stayed a few days. We again covered that same thing, the storage of fuel and the ammunition renovation. And one of the sites was where it was stored was a tunnel that was built during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the inside of the tunnel was gigantic. It was at the mouth of the tunnel, two railroad cars could get into it side by side.
Mm.
And once you were in the tunnel, it was probably, oh, I don't know, I'm going to say 50, 60 feet high.
Wow.
And it was all lined with stones and bricks, and it was just incredible. I mean, this was built, you know, for keeping the war going during World War II, if
mm-hmm.
they had to.
Mm-hmm.
It went back, oh, probably a quarter of a mile, if not more.
Wow.
But we had, in there, most of it was fuel that was being stored
mm-hmm.
inside there. We did go to Hiroshima, and we seen that.
On business or pleasure?
That was pleasure.
Okay.
And we finished up in Sasebo, and that's where the oil, lots of oil terminals were,
mm-hmm.
and that's where a U.S. Navy base was as well. And I think they refueled, I know there was an aircraft carrier there that was off the shores of Vietnam, and that's where they would get new supplies and refuel and
mm-hmm.
get back.
Okay.
We took, while we were in Japan, I remember taking a public train, one of those fast trains.
Mm-hmm.
We flew Japanese Airlines and actually flew real close to Mount Fuji. We stayed in some old Japanese inns. This was before, you know, Americans really traveled throughout Japan and the economy had taken off. We used to sleep on the tatami mats and had the soji screens. And
mm-hmm.
But Bill San Hamill, he had some pressing business back in Taipei. I actually think he was going back to see a girlfriend or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he left us in Tokyo, and he took leave and flew back to Taipei. And we were supposed to fly back to Hawaii. And when Bill left us, he also took his portion of the weight allowance with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to check in on our civilian aircraft, and we were told we were so far overweight it wasn't funny.
Hmm.
So we called Hawaii, and Hawaii said, well, now we were making $26 a day for per diem there.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, I guess it's going to be a week or so before we get you your orders. Enjoy Tokyo. And we stayed at the Stars and Stripes Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Stars and Stripes newspaper?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Well, that was where the headquarters was.
Okay.
And for $2 a day, we had like a dorm room, you know, a quad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. So we had a nice week vacation paid for by the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of touring there and enjoyed that a great deal. Then it was back to Hawaii. And
how long did this TDY last?
That one was I think I came back the 13th of September. Where'd I go? August, first part of August. I guess about 6 weeks.
Okay.
7 weeks, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we were back in Hawaii, and we did find a, I did find an apartment with three other guys from our unit. It was great because usually there was two of us were there at the most at any given time. Mm-hmm. And I was only back 39 days before I was sent to Korea.
Okay.
I arrived in Korea on the 22nd of October.
Okay.
And this Captain Richards that I mentioned earlier that used to have us over to his house, and he was a real jokester. And I remember standing in line to get processed after I got off the plane,
mm-hmm.
and there were no DASPO people there to greet me, which that was really unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And this line kept moving really slow. And finally, around the corner, I see guys dropping their pants. And they're getting shots with a horse vial. And it was a gamma-gabio shot because a lot of guys were coming down with spinal meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Dick Richards let the line get to about four or five guys just before it's my turn. He's laughing like crazy. And he says, "Come here, get out of line." He thought that was really funny.
Were you laughing at this point?
I was not laughing at that point.
Uh-huh. You were relieved not to get that shot, though.
Yeah, I was real relieved not to get. I mean, because we had international shot records that were filled up. I mean, because of our TDY,
mm-hmm.
every time we went out and back and forth, some of the shots had to be given again.
Right.
And oh, Jesus. We got to know the medics over at the place there in Fort Shafter mm-hmm. by name almost. Well, anyway, we stayed in a villa. It was more of a true villa than we had in Vietnam.
Was this in Seoul?
This was in Seoul.
Okay.
Yep. And I was greeted at the door by Mr. and Mrs. Yi. They were an elderly couple that they looked after us. They cooked and cleaned and washed our clothes. They also had a little dog that ended up being our mascot.
Mm-hmm.
Their, Mr. Yi's father was a Korean general who actually built the house, and he rented it out to, you know, anyone for income.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we had that house for about 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
And the Yi's had a little small house behind ours. And they were probably in their 50s or 60s when they were, working for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the big assignment that we were sent for Korea for was, of course, to document the Pueblo crew release.
Okay.
And while we were waiting for that major release, we covered everything from railroad tunnels and bridges to North Korean infiltrators trying to kill the president of South Korea.
Wow.
And again, I traveled all over that country, mm-hmm. from one end of it to another. And it was kind of an interesting country. They had an actual fall like what we have in Michigan, and,
mm-hmm.
But a lousy, lousy winter.
Mm-hmm.
Really cold there. Kalmage B. Harbison, he was, I think he and I both went over at the same time, and he was working with me on a story covering bridges and tunnels, and God, we were out forever, and we had a Ford Scout, I think that was the name of the truck. It was
mm-hmm.
kind of a forerunner to an SUV.
Mm-hmm.
We had blowouts all the time, and one night we slept outside in our mummy bags, and we woke up with about 6 inches of snow on us.
Wow!
We ended up sleeping in a jail. We couldn't sleep in the truck because we had so much equipment in it.
Mm-hmm.
And but we had Talmage B. That's what we called him.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great opportunity to cover some combat in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And about 60 North Korean infiltrators were. These guys were tough. I mean, I actually think they were probably even tougher than our special forces.
Mm.
They were making their way south, and their objective was to get to Seoul and kill the president of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Army, they provided helicopter support from the 6th Aviation Platoon, and they helped move the troops around and, helped spot for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And these North Koreans, they were... amazing. They were jumping ahead of these blocking lines because they were moving so fast. But boy, I'll tell you what, the South Koreans, every time we caught up with them, they were dragging dead bodies with them,
hmm.
of these North. They
mm-hmm.
were catching them one by one. But we'd been with one chopper crew all day, and at the end of the day, the other chopper crew asked us to cover them, and I had actually stepped aboard their chopper. And Talmadge said, hey, let's stay with the group we've been with. They were heading back to their base and over this Ulchin mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we took off for the base. The other chopper radioed to us about a snowstorm that they had run into, and they said they were going to climb over it and come over the ocean and come back in underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And our pilot decided to follow the mountain roads. And we're flying really low, and the storm was coming at us, and not only was it getting dark, we were running out of fuel. And there was one other thing to worry about, 60 North Koreans, probably only about 40 of them left by that time. But we really were running out of fuel, and we're trying to find a place to land on the roads. And Talmadge was on one rail of the chopper, and I was on the other looking for power lines, making sure he wasn't going to hit any power lines or any trees. And we actually had to land. And just as we were landing, they got a call saying that this was as the fuel light was turning red.
Mm-hmm.
They got a call over the radio saying the other chopper had disappeared off the radar screen over the Sea of Japan.
Wow.
And they never did find anyone. They didn't even find a piece of the helicopter.
Really?
Yeah. Everybody, I mean, completely missing.
Wow.
And
you had been aboard that, actually. You were getting ready to take that
chopper. I was on it, yeah. Yeah, and if Talmadge hadn't said, let's stay with the crew we had, I'm thinking, wow. You know, talk about nine lives, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just wonder why things like that happen to you, you know. I was starting to feel like a cat with nine lives. Well, we landed that chopper on the side of the road, and one of the crew saw a bus coming down the hill and flagged it down, and he rode that back to the base. And they knew we were coming in, and they had a truck ready, and got back on that fuel truck and showed them where it was at. And we had a choice of either riding that chopper back into the base or taking the fuel truck back in. And mm-hmm. Talmadge and I discussed it, and we decided to take the empty fuel truck back in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys were so... I mean, they needed some time by themselves because of what happened to their,
right.
their buddies.
Right.
And let's see, I don't know, late November, I'd gone into this, into the villa. I'd been out, Captain Griffith, who had just replaced Captain Richards a few weeks ago, was trying to get us all together, and he looked pale, and we knew something was up, and we had no idea. He told us all to come in this dining room that we had, and he said he was just informed that by Hawaii that Rick Ryan had been killed.
Mm.
And, gosh, I mean, you know, you just can't believe, you know, just, I mean, you just, I think of probably Rick at least once or twice a week.
Really?
Every day of my life, yeah.
What happened to him?
Rick was covering a story up in, he was covering a story on, people sniffers, and he was in one of the people sniffers actually doing cutaways of a guy manipulating it. A people sniffer is a helicopter that's got very sensitive devices in it that can actually tell if there's troop movement through an area by detecting body odor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shot down by a either by a missile or an anti-aircraft gun, and he was part of part of this story. I mean, the other guys had done the cutaways the day before, and he said, "Nah, it's my turn." And he was really a very talented guy, and one of the nicest guys in DASPO.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then I also got to know his family, which was really really sad. But the mission that he was sent on, it really could have been filmed in Saigon, because there was a unit of people sniffers there working, and
mm-hmm.
the OIC, the officer in charge, his name was Peter Friend, decided that our guys had been spending too much time in Saigon or other reasons, and he wanted them out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us never had forgiven him for what he did. I mean, it was just a casual way to waste the life of a young guy. He didn't need to be sent up there to do that story.
How did you deal with that personally at the time?
Well, I didn't. You mean with Rick's death?
Yes, sir.
At the time, I guess first thing I did is write his mother a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the archives has got a copy of that, her return to me. I just had to be alone for a while, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to get out of the villa and walk and think it through. I mean, it just certainly made an impact on me, and like I say, I still think of Rick every week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, I didn't know about this. We didn't know about all of the things that went on with his death. I mean, all I knew is that he was, you know, in that people sniffer. But later when we got back, you know, I was told about, you know, what happened. I mean, a lot of guys in our unit were really, really upset about this. And usually the officer in charge, there is a body to be identified. He's supposed to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he made one of my other friends, Chuck Abbott, do it. And
so this guy didn't even go identify the body?
No, he wouldn't go. He didn't want to do that. And he was not a very well liked man in our unit. And I think I'll talk to you a little bit later about that. But,
okay.
After Rick's death, Captain Griffith did get us some enlightenment. And he got us into film the Bob Hope Show.
Okay.
And that kind of took our minds off of mm-hmm. off of Rick. And
where was the show?
It was in Seoul.
Okay.
And gosh, I don't even know if I ever got to see Bob. I did get to meet Ann Margaret and Tom Mentir. Buddy shot a color photo of her. It was a great shot. And he mm-hmm. gave one of the prints to me, and I actually got it signed about 6 years ago by her.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm going to donate to the Texas Tech. I have about 400 feet of film that I shot that day and
mm-hmm.
processed, had paid for the processing myself, and I'll get that donated to Texas Tech.
Okay.
But it was fun. It was great going there and seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing that happened was December 23rd, 1968. What we'd been waiting for actually
mm-hmm.
came to fruition. It was we got word the crew was being released, and we'd been waiting for months. So this was really one of the most historical events I probably would document.
Mm-hmm.
I was the head MOPIC cameraman and the one with the most responsibility on that release.
Mm-hmm.
And much of the film that we were going to shoot would end up going out of Japan it was going to be processed in Japan and sent out by satellite. That was really something back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So we really only had one chance to really get this. And everything I'd learned all the training, everything I'd been through, had really had better, you know, treat me well then, because
right.
We really had only one opportunity. And I know seeing that crew walking towards the hospital with their heavy winter jackets supplied by Uncle Sam and the POW garb they wore,
mm-hmm.
the North Koreans had given them, it was a wonderful sight for mm-hmm. all of us. And I remember people clapping and yelling, and the next series of shots of them was them signing in. They had so they could all be accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
And after signing in, different corpsmen led them to different beds, and we were capturing all of this using sync sound, and I had a sound guy, Talmadge Harbison, following me around while I was shooting all of this. And we really had to be agile to get that mic in and keep, because they had an umbilical cord to me to the tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be really careful. And I do remember Commander Butcher making sure, I mean, this guy was just hobbled. I mean, he could hardly walk.
Mm-hmm.
And he made sure every single one of his men were in a bed before he took his own.
Really?
And the civilian press wasn't allowed to capture any of this inside the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, one of the crewmen asking me who won the World Series. They didn't even know who did won that.
Right.
And another one asking me about somebody in a popular comic strip, and I can't remember what that was about, if it was Dick Tracy or somebody
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we were told by Army Intelligence not to speak to these guys and not answer any of their questions, but we answered those questions. What the hell? What are they going to do?
Right. Pretty harmless.
Yeah. Send me to Vietnam or something.
Yeah, really.
But these guys had taken some real beatings, and we had one of our other guys actually, a still guy and another motion picture guy, filming the bruises and the, you know, where they'd been beaten.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw that on their hands or their faces, but it was the rest of their body that was, you know, that they documented this for. Because, I mean, I think they were hoping to, you know, press charges against these Korean captors.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just a great story. I mean, December 24th, we filmed them, you know, going back to the U.S. on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting back to our villa quite late, writing and typing the captions and downloading all the film and, you know, getting everything ready. It was to get, you know, sent out. And we left, a couple of us drove out in a quarter-ton truck at our villa.
Mm-hmm.
It was snowing out, and we got, I think it was about 11 p.m. when we got the film on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall someone was with me, and we were really cold, but I'll tell you what, it was a nice Christmas present for
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great seeing those guys get out of there and all those beatings going on. And mm-hmm. we got back after midnight, and Christmas morning, the Yees cooked us a special Christmas meal.
Mm.
And the team got letters of accommodations, all of us did, for the job that we did there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I think one of the last jobs I did in Korea was rock training for Vietnam.
Okay.
And watching these guys do taekwondo on each other and breaking
mm-hmm.
bricks with their foreheads. I knew. I said, man, the Vietnamese are in trouble with these guys. When these guys come into town, the people in Korea were great. They were really friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Even back in those days, though, the students protested. I mean, it was amazing. But we're going back to 1968,
mm-hmm.
and they still were protesting back then. And to this day, I guess the students in Korea always
yes,
find something to protest about.
Yes, sir.
But they were great to us. I mean, they were very, very good to us. And I remember being out doing one of these stories on one of the railroad bridges all by myself,
mm-hmm.
and this Korean woman saw me, and she walked a couple hundred yards back to her little hut. She came out with a jug, and it was rice wine.
Hmm.
She kept handing me the rice wine and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And something must have happened to her during the Korean War that was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
one weekend, we told Captain Griffith that we were having troubles with one of the cameras in ARBL. And
mm-hmm.
One of the guys in our group knew someone from the Navy's camera repair team, and they were in Seoul. So when Captain Griffith left one morning, I faked working on the BL. And when he came back that afternoon, the Navy guys had already been there and torn the camera. I mean, this thing was in thousands of parts.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick Griffith was going crazy. He was furious, just furious, you know. How in the hell could you rip something like this apart? You know, just, I mean, he stormed out of the house, and his last words, you better get that effing camera back together, and it better work. Well, he left, and the Navy guys came back and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done this 100 times before, so they said, well, here's a couple of extra spare parts.
Mm-hmm.
And they scattered them on the table. And he says, this will drive somebody nuts. And when Rick came back, they were correct, because I told him I got the camera working, but I didn't know where all these parts went.
Mm-hmm.
He just went ballistic again, and he had a very short fuse, and I mean, you could just see the face getting red. I just couldn't keep a straight face, and I started laughing. And actually, he took it pretty good, and I was lucky that he didn't court-martial me.
It sounds like you guys had a really good relationship, all of you.
Yeah, pretty good. It really was. That was the end of Korea, and I went back to Hawaii.
When did you go back, in January 69?
January 21st of 1969.
Okay.
And then I had a couple more trips to Vietnam.
Okay.
Do you have time to continue, or do you want to stop now?
Let me break just for a second here.
Sure.
Let me ask you a question about, if you could, compare the different cultures in Asia. You've experienced Thai, Vietnamese, Taiwanese, Japanese, and Korean. Are there any conclusions or anything you can say in general about the different cultures of Asia?
Wow.
The big question, I know, but...
Yeah, it's like almost as diverse as Europe is, mm-hmm. in some ways, but somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Buddhist culture in Thailand affected them in one way, positively, and they were, I mean, one group that was just such a wonderful group to be around,
mm-hmm.
and the Koreans were very, very harsh. Their land is harsh, their language is harsh, and they're very hard-working, industrious people.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Taiwan. They were very, very, I think they had a harsh time as well. And they were very industrious and hardworking people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only people that I know, that the majority of that tried to get around being very industrious, was probably the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I understood that later on, but at the time I didn't understand it.
Okay.
And of course the Japanese were very hardworking, industrious people as well.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, I think the people in Southeast Asia were the one thread that really, was common was hard work.
Okay, I've heard that before from other veterans. Their impression that the people there had to put up with a lot and did a lot.
I mean, the way their living conditions were, and the way that they did it, they did put up with an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Korea, for example, in the winter, they had electricity, but they didn't have stoves, and they had these warmers that they'd put underneath the house. A lot of people died from asphyxiation,
mm-hmm.
because of that. And they were just, they'd get up in the morning, go to work.
Mm-hmm.
They might even have an outside John.
Right. Where did you feel more welcome as an American, in which society?
Wow. I think Thailand.
Okay.
By far.
Mm-hmm.
And then Korea as well. I felt very welcome in Korea. I don't know if that still holds true, but a lot of the people that were, that generation was the generation that was saved by, the Korean vets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people were very happy they didn't end up under communist control.
Right. Okay. So you get back to Hawaii.
Yeah, I went back to Hawaii for a little while, and I ended up back in Vietnam on March 3rd, 1969.
Okay.
And one of the first jobs I did was a story on the Sherman tank.
Now, were you based again at Saigon?
Yes, same place.
Same place. Okay, at the villa.
Yeah. And I know guys later, I think it's sometime in 70, they closed the villa down and they moved into some hotels,
mm-hmm.
military, what they called military hotels. But all of my trips were into Vietnam, I stayed at the villa.
Okay.
Well, Congress wanted, they were getting reports on the Sherman tank not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
It was getting a lot of reports on this tank not being able to... climb over certain rice paddies, and they were stalling a lot. And, so I was sent to Coochee to cover an operation that was being supported by this tank.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't run into any enemy fire, but we found some dead bodies that were left behind. They must have dropped them and ran, because usually they don't just leave their dead laying there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we filmed how the tank overheated and couldn't climb over the dikes at the rice paddies, and how easy it was for the tank turrets to get hit by an RPG and get blown off the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also were showed how they used chicken wire and cyclone fencing around the top of the turrets,
mm-hmm,
to deflect these RPGs, and how they also actually developed bags to hold these. That was the first tank not to have the would fire the round out, and there wouldn't be a casing.
Okay.
And one of the problems they had was when they were storing the powder that would shoot the round out, they'd get hit by an RPG and it would overheat the, didn't actually have to go through the turret, but it heated the turret up,
mm-hmm,
so hot that it would cook off those rounds and blow the tank up.
Mm-hmm.
And the other bad thing was the in Vietnam, I mean, these tanks were going through a lot of jungle, and it was just being sucked into the radiator, and they were overheating.
How did the tankers feel about you documenting the problems with their vehicle?
They felt good about it. I don't think the commanders liked it too well. Mm-hmm. And this was one of those cases like, what the hell are you doing here, and why are you,
mm-hmm,
it was one of those cases where if we had not been DASPO, I think we could have been easily biased and filmed that from a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
But we filmed it the way we saw it, and mm-hmm, sent our notes in, and they took it as such.
How conscious were your superiors about making sure that you guys did your job without bias?
They weren't.
Okay.
I think we were more conscious of it,
okay,
of being non-biased in everything we did.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of guys back in Hawaii that was one of their main concerns was us doing our job and not being biased.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the first sergeant. He'd been with DASPO for quite some time, and his name was Ken Bridgham, and he was just a terrific guy. And I think he wanted to make sure we did this the best way we possibly could, and that was being non-biased.
Mm-hmm.
And the commanding officer that we had, I'm trying to think, we had a guy named Captain Duke Austin, and after him, I have to think of his name, but he also believed in doing the job the best way we could and,
mm-hmm,
being non-biased. But we didn't hear a lot about it. Okay,
that's right.
So we really kind of took that on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I used to go down to the Delta and fly with my cousin. He was a forward air commander in the Air Force,
mm-hmm,
and stationed in Mito.
Okay.
And I used to go down and visit him, and he took me up on a mission, and I began filming it, and I never knew a prop plane could do the contortions that thing could do.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting, the camera I was shooting, I was looking out through the prism of the camera, and,
mm-hmm,
and it was rotating. I didn't realize it was throwing my equilibrium off.
Mm-hmm.
I got sicker at a dog.
Oh, really?
Threw up in my jungle hat, and he really laughed his butt off because he thought he did it because of all the gyrations and everything else he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first meeting with my cousins, first time I ever met him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he thought it was quite humorous that he got an Army grunt to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And but we became good friends, and I flew with him a lot down there, and he came up to the villa a few times, and he tried to make me sick, and I never lost it again, but I never took a camera that I had to look through the prism lens again,
mm-hmm,
the mirrored shutter.
Now, you tried to explain to him why you had gotten sick, I'm sure.
Yeah, I did. He didn't buy it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. One of those missions, we saw one of the Australian Batwing British bombers.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of neat to see.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we were coming back where Bud had fired a bunch of rockets into a dike along a river.
Mm-hmm.
Bed, and the F-4s came in and targeted it. And he had one rocket left. We called him Willie Peter, mm-hmm. white phosphorus, where they would light up the area.
Mm-hmm.
And we were flying back over a free fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw anybody in that free fire zone, you were supposed to, you know, blow them out of the water, or in this case, the delta was a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put them out of their misery. But there was this old bearded papa-san in a dugout canoe going across the water, and we did a look-see, and went down and to see what we could see from the air.
Mm-hmm.
And Bud said, you know, he gave me a little history lesson. He said, you know, this guy's probably been, his family's probably been in this area for 300 years. And he said, you know, we're supposed to take guys out like this. He said, they're not supposed to be here. He said, so I got a fire on them. And the rocket went a mile in the wrong direction. He said, geez, I missed.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And the day before I got down there, this on one of the last trips, one of his pilots had gone to a commissary and filled up the plane with beer.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back, the beer shifted, and these were Cessnas, and,
mm-hmm.
and it came moved against the stick. And they found the pilot and trying to push the beer away from the back seat when it crashed into the ground.
Wow.
What else did I do while I was there? Let's see. I spent a week working on a mission with Special Forces, training Cambodian Army units to become paratroopers. And,
where was this?
That was up near Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And we actually filmed them jumping a week after they'd been went through the quick airborne school of 1 week. That was used by was ABC.
Mm-hmm.
That's another network story.
Let me interrupt real quick. What was your impression of the Cambodians?
They were really quiet, and they really hung to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed to be kind of tough, but we really didn't get very close to them.
Mm-hmm.
Special Forces kept them kind of, I mean, once we got done filming, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even go into the compound with them.
Okay.
So we were staying at a public information office, and they were quite a ways away from the Cameron Bay. They were in some Special Forces camp. I can't recall where. I mean, it was just outside Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's see. Another story that made it to network TV, and that was used by ABC and NBC, was the Red Cross covering the treatment. They came in to see how the NVA POWs were being treated at the Long Bend 74th POW Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about April 24th, 69. And it was interesting. They were repatriating some of more serious amputees back to North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an NVA doctor who was captured, but he refused to... He had been seriously wounded, and can't remember what happened to him, but he stayed.
Mm-hmm.
He refused to be repatriated.
Really?
Yeah. And the Red Cross were mainly Swiss that were there.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make sure that these people had, you know, humane treatment. And I was real surprised. They were very cautious about us filming them because they didn't want us using that as, any way that we could for propaganda use.
Right. What did you see as far as the treatment of the NVA prisoners?
Oh, they were treated very well, they really were treated well. They got good food and they got good medical care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Swiss were real pleased in what they saw.
Okay.
As opposed to probably how our guys were treated.
Did they get in to see our guys that you were aware of?
The Red Cross?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I know they were allowed at some points at some time.
Yeah,
but,
that was probably later.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably well after I left Vietnam.
I didn't know if they had talked about it any.
No.
Okay.
They were very, very quiet and very. They just really didn't. They felt uncomfortable that we were even there.
Hmm.
What was interesting, the POW hospital was near the place called the Long Bin Jail,
mm-hmm.
LBJ, they called it. And that was a real hideous sight. I mean, these were some GIs that had committed something very serious while they were in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The men slept inside of metal Connex containers at night. And they used them to get out of the rain. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been 130 degrees in those during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of these Connex containers, it was encircled with concertina wire.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how many of these were there, but they were also surrounded by fences with more concertina wire.
Mm-hmm.
In all four corners, there were guard towers with MPs manning them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought it was bad enough to be in Vietnam, but I couldn't believe anything could be worse.
Right.
Trying to think of anything else.
How long did this particular TDY last?
Well, I was there for 3 months.
Okay.
We went up to the... Hang on a second.
Okay, go ahead.
I did another interesting story. We went up to the Highlands,
mm-hmm.
Outside of Pleiku to cover a story on Army chaplains.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really a gruesome assignment. That fire base had been actually overrun the night before.
Oh, really?
And they called in airstrikes on their own position.
Mm.
And there was 150 NVA dead outside the perimeter. And rigor mortis was setting in. I mean, mm-hmm. they looked like statues.
Really?
It was just the most amazing sight I'd ever seen.
Did you film all this?
Filmed that, yeah.
Okay.
And some of the bodies that made it inside the perimeter, they had no way of disposing of these guys. So when they blew up the ammo dump, they were blown up as well.
Hmm.
There was just a lot of U.S. soldiers in body bags. When the chaplain was there, he helped the soldiers grieve over that,
mm-hmm.
and he said a mass that I filmed, and
mm-hmm.
I mean they were lucky they survived. I mean they literally we talked to the CO and he said it was just hand to hand, and he said they just hunkered down and called an airstrike in on their own position.
Hmm.
And I think after. After 1968, the Pentagon wanted more stories and less combat. And
mm-hmm.
President Nixon was starting his his withdrawal from Vietnam about that mm-hmm. time.
Yes, sir.
And we found out we had to stay more and more out of Saigon because we were burning up too much TDY. And so we had a bunch of dedicated guys that really wanted to make good documentary stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most interesting stories I did while I was there was the filming of setting up and tearing down of artillery fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
And, Tom Mintier, myself, John Gilroy, and a guy named Joe Primo, who was the still guy on it. We would just go out and just keep shooting these things over and over different angles. That
mm-hmm.
The editor had something to... We really had our creative juices going on that.
Mm-hmm.
And... That was one of the better stories that I think we actually did. I think it was probably the best job I ever did at DASPO.
As far as tearing down fire bases and moving them?
Yes, how to set up. Yeah, they were. The Pentagon was asked by the artillery department to set up, see if they could get us to do a training film
mm-hmm.
on how to do this, how to set up a fire base, and then how to tear it down.
Okay.
In a war zone,
mm-hmm.
And the efforts for this job, I was awarded Cinematographer of the Year for the Department of Defense.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
what made it so good in your mind?
Well, it was just one of those jobs that we had time to do. Mm-hmm. We had it was an interesting job to film, and we had all of the enthusiasm of all the commanders mm-hmm. and generals that were in Vietnam to get this story out
mm-hmm.
and get this training going, and really was a good story to do, and I mean I got letters from appreciation from general officers. I got a commendation from the Assistant Secretary of Defense
mm-hmm.
for this job. I mean, it was a great job. Fort Sill was the the job was tasked for,
mm-hmm.
and John Gilroy was our lieutenant. He was one of the few guys that would go out in the field. One of the few officers that actually went out with us,
mm-hmm.
and I'm telling you, we just took tons of equipment. I mean, it was really a pain in the butt when we had to make a move, because it was just four of us humping this stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they were setting up these fire bases in the Parrot's Beak,
right?
And literally yards. I mean, who knew? I mean, we actually could have been in Cambodia. I'm not sure. But what they would do is they would do these star positions with the 105 howitzers at each point.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd dig a large moat. They'd bring in bulldozers, and they would make literally a moat around it. And they filled it with just about anything they could of ammunition, and then they put 50-gallon drums of a mixture of gas, airplane fuel, and, what's that sticky... stuff that I'm trying to think of the right word. They'd get on you and burn you. Oh God!
The napalm.
Napalm.
Okay.
They'd mix napalm in with it as well.
Okay.
And this was all inside the moat. They had concertina wire thrown in there and concertina wire outside the moat. And machine guns were placed strategically around, in between all of these howitzers.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the day, the base was bracketed by artillery bases, far away.
Mm-hmm.
And the howitzers were loaded with special shells, like white phosphorus
mm-hmm.
or these flechettes. And they only had a range of about 50 yards before they would explode. And, they weren't trying to, fire way out and get infantrymen. They were just waiting for people to come at them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also had puff up in the air.
Okay.
And they would wait. They had about a company of artillerymen in there, and they would wait until the inevitable. And you could see the lights. I mean, I wasn't there when they did this. We came. I mean, this after they did this three times, they had us document it. But I was told that they'd see the lights of the trucks from the NVA,
mm-hmm.
and the NVA would attack, and I mean they'd get to that start to cut through the concertina wire, and I guess the first thing they'd be jumping and trying to get across the moat, and they'd light that up so that the puff could see where the fire base was,
mm-hmm.
and simultaneously the artillery bases let go. And as they were charging, the howitzers were letting go, and I mean it was a real onslaught that they would just, it was really a very effective way to get the enemy suckered in.
Did you get to film this?
No, we did not get to film it.
Okay.
When we got there, they got smart. They actually had a body count. The three times they set it up, the body count was about 450.
Wow.
NVA. No casualties for us at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they when they got this reported to headquarters. I mean, that's how we were. Finally, this assignment came around, and they said, "We want you guys to film this because this is an effective way to set up a fire base and kill as many people as we possibly can."
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we got there, they had done it about three times, and the last time I think the kill rate had gone down significantly.
Mm-hmm.
The NVA were getting a little bit smarter.
Right. Let me ask you a question about a technical question. Did
sure.
you narrate any of your film? Did you do voiceovers, or
no.
was it just simply the footage?
Simply the footage
okay.
and wild sound or sync sound.
Okay. All right. And if we could go back, tell me about the Army chaplains and your impression of them.
Wow. They were some great guys. Some of them were real military, and other ones were just very compassionate people. And this guy that we filmed going out, we did a whole story on chaplains, and I just did one portion of it. That mm-hmm. would be that particular one. Mm-hmm. Because it was tasked. I mean, we probably had three different crews out filming them. And the one chaplain that I was with was a very compassionate man. I mean, he had to listen to a lot of things and hold up these guys after what they'd gone through.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that was probably the only chaplain I actually, you know, really got to talk to.
Right. Okay. Okay. Do you need to say anything else about the firebase?
Yeah. We met with the commanding general that was in charge of artillery in Vietnam, and
mm-hmm.
we actually filmed him in his bunker, and he went through how he would set up this type of thing, and we brought a lighting package even, and it was the first time we'd used that thing, and
mm-hmm.
We kept blowing out his generators, but we got what we needed, and then the next morning we were flown to a base that they were tearing down, and at that time we needed to demonstrate how these shells worked.
Mm-hmm.
And the basically the positions of how these things sat up, you know, the stars, how they sat in the star system.
Are you talking about the 50 millimeter?
Yeah, the 105s.
Okay, oh, the 105s, all right.
Yeah, and so they let us, you know, they fired off a few rounds, and they started tearing the base down that afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and a squad of infantry was left to defend that perimeter
mm-hmm.
with a skeleton crew on the howitzers. I mean, if they were going to attack, you know, we filmed until dark, and then we realized we were there with just a squad.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. And we knew every time they were setting up these bases, they were attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And we were wondering, God, how vulnerable are we?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we were given some M16s, and we were asked to defend a section of the perimeter. We said, look, you know, we declined, saying we had no experience in what to do. I mean, we were cameramen.
Right.
We said, you know, if the base gets attacked, we'll try to help you at night, but that's all we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And at night long, they popped off flares, and we didn't get any sleep. And then the next morning, the base was dismantled, and while I was going from one camera position to another, I stumbled over two AK-47s that day.
Mm-hmm.
They were just laying in the dust. And I found a bolt action rifle. I took those back to the villa and put them up on the wall as war trophies.
Mm-hmm.
Never did try to bring them back, but I always wonder what happened to those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't believe the dust from the Sikorskys and the, you know, as they picked up these equipment. I mean, everything we had shut. It was tight. It was just filled. Our equipment was awful. I mean, I'd never seen so much dust. And
now I wanted to ask you, how did you keep your equipment so, you know, in operation and functional in such an environment?
Oh, I mean, we really were paying attention to it all the time. I mean, if guys weren't paying attention to their equipment, they ended up with a bad job because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was rampant. I mean, you had the moisture, humidity, or the
mm-hmm.
dust.
Mm-hmm.
And this place was awful. I mean, when we walked back into base camp, people walked away from us. I mean, I don't think we could have gotten any dirtier. I mean, literally, they gave us new fatigues and undershorts when we got there.
They just gave up and gave you a whole new outfit.
And, I mean, the other ones, we didn't even bother. We just threw them away.
Right.
And I think we held the record for the longest shower in Nam, too. But then we had to sit down and clean our equipment. I mean, it
mm-hmm.
was just filthy. The other interesting, I mean, we continued on filming this, setting up a base somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other interesting jobs we filmed was the 1 millionth Army R&R guy. I think it was like March 31st to April 5th. We covered a guy that was in the Brownwater Navy.
Okay.
And each service had its delegate for 1/1,000,000th R&R.
Mm-hmm.
And this Army guy was a river rat in the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out and filmed him doing his job and went on patrols with him down the Delta and swapping
wow.
sampans and checking for weapons. And
mm-hmm.
we filmed him writing to his wife. And he was getting an all-expense-paid trip to Hawaii where his wife would be flown in as well. They were going to be put up at, you know, one of the best hotels in Hawaii. And
mm-hmm.
they had a deal where they were going to fly to the other islands and see different things. And
mm-hmm.
then we brought this guy into Saigon where he shopped for gifts for his wife. And we spent 2 weeks filming him. We finished the job, and it was on a plane going back to Washington. And, I mean, we really captured the essence of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really excited about meeting his wife.
I can imagine.
But as it turned out, he got a Dear John letter.
Oh, right, no.
Before he was supposed to leave, saying she found another man and wasn't joining him.
Oh, no. Did you film that?
No. We heard about it after everything was filmed.
Oh, okay.
All I know is the Army was really pissed off.
Oh.
They picked another guy from a different group, and a different group of DASPO guys went and shot him. And I don't know if that poor guy was ever compensated or not, that first guy. Can you imagine
that's
that?
That's terrible.
Awful, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pictures in my file of this guy where we were filming him
mm-hmm.
back in Saigon and also on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was my second trip, and I returned May 29th.
Okay. What was it like on the Mekong Delta down there in the river?
That was really different for me to be going up and down the river, and you never knew what and who you were stopping, and
mm-hmm.
and some of the places where the river, we were going up smaller channels, and they never knew if there was going to be an ambush or not,
mm-hmm.
because it certainly was an uninhabited area,
mm-hmm.
and it was another different piece of commerce that we got to see.
Right.
Shipping out that used to be the rice capital, the breadbasket of Southeast Asia at
yes,
one
sir.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was a lot of commerce down in that area.
Do you want to go ahead and take a break for today?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
And
we'll go ahead and sign it off right now then.
Yeah.
This is Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Theodore Acheson. Today is the 29th of April. It's approximately 9:35 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, and Mr. Acheson is in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Sir, before we continue with your narrative, with the story, you said that you had something that you wanted to add to your very first Vietnam tour back in 68.
That's correct. I wanted to express there was another officer that did go out, who really was looking for combat,
mm-hmm.
and his name was, he was a captain, and his name was Rick Griffith, and he was really gung-ho about getting combat, and his idea was that the group would go out and find the combat that was going on. This was during the second Tet Offensive of 1968, where they tried to overrun Saigon once again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he had ever gone out in the field before, and we weren't far. This was all happening in and around Saigon where he was. And he was going to go out and give the photographic team fire coverage if they got into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he thought this was fun and games, in my opinion, and I think also Brian Grigsby will express it as well, and maybe even Harry Breedlove and Alfred Batumbacall, who had gone out with them. Instead of giving covering fire if they needed it, he actually was firing on the NVA and the VC, drawing fire to the camera teams, doing just the opposite of what his original so-called intent was.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of keeping the team out of harm's way, it actually was putting the team in harm's way.
Okay.
And Captain Griffith found out that it really wasn't fun and games. Harry Breedlove had gotten shot in the leg. I can't remember if he was hit by a bullet or if it was shrapnel. I think he was hit by a round. the day before, and the next day it was no one got hit, and then the day after that, Captain Griffith got part of his arm shot off. Again, I had mentioned that there weren't officers. Some of the officers didn't. Most of the officers never went into the field.
Mm-hmm.
He was one that did, which we wished that he hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some like John Gilroy and Carl Williams, both officers who would go out with the men and try to do make our jobs better and enhance the assignments.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, do you want to jump back to...
Yeah, let's go back.
You
right?
returned to Hawaii after your second Vietnam tour.
Yeah, I went back to Hawaii, and gosh, I remember sitting in my apartment and watching Neil Armstrong live put his foot on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I had a nice 53 MG that I always was working on. I think all of my buddies would attest to that. They mm-hmm. had to push that car, come and pick me up, or do something. it was always breaking down. But it was a cool car.
Mm-hmm.
It was a neat little car.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had it stripped down at the base garage, painting it and restoring it. And I had plenty of time because I had orders to go back to Thailand once again. Boy, I was really excited about going back to Thailand again.
Right.
I love Thailand. And one of the guys, as I mentioned before, this one fellow that used to jump off the third floor, Crazy Steve Paquette, he had recently gotten married.
Okay.
And... his wife had come down with spinal meningitis. Well, Steve got sent back to Hawaii, and I was the next one to rotate out. Instead of going back to Thailand,
mm-hmm.
I got sent back to Vietnam on August 13th to replace him.
How did you feel about not getting Thailand and going back to Nam?
I was so disappointed. And again, that was one of the last places in the world I wanted to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, every day I spent there, the odds were getting stacked against me.
Right.
And I even though the last time, I went out on a few combat operations, it was still, anything could happen at any time, but fortunately nothing did. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, after I got back to Vietnam, first assignment I had was covering President Nixon's withdrawal of troops,
mm-hmm.
and this was his first group to go back to the U.S., and we were shooting them up in Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I do not recall the unit the first unit to be sent out under his agreement to bring to Vietnamize Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was up there, we kept getting these false reports. Go here, go there. They're gonna leave. They're not gonna leave. And I was always cleaning my camera gate and getting ready to shoot. And really was working very hard at making sure everything was all in order. And when we finally got the call, we headed out to Cameron, and shots were like, guys walking up, and the stewardess is giving them kisses and. Waving in. They even had a little band playing there, and gosh, I just did all kinds of shots of the band, and the stewardesses throwing kisses, and
mm-hmm.
and I shot it until the plane pulled away, and I thought to myself, God, I've been shooting this for a long time. I hadn't had to change magazines. I'm wondering what in the heck was going on. Well, my film counter, and I was shooting this with what's called an Arri BL,
mm-hmm.
and it was a sync sound job. I looked at my film counter, and I'd shot 800 feet.
Hmm.
Well, that was pretty... That's almost impossible, because it's only a 400-foot roll in the camera. I opened up the camera, and with all my preparations, all the waiting, all the cleaning of the gate and everything else, somewhere along the line, I forgot to put the film back into the film gate.
Oh, boy.
I had nothing. But lucky for me, and... lucky for the viewers back in the United States, there was a second plane because they needed more than one plane
mm-hmm.
to take these guys back. So they did the same thing. They struck up the band. The stewardesses were throwing kisses and kissing the guys as they were going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, what the American public saw was not the first real group to leave Vietnam. They saw the second group.
Well, that worked out well for you.
Yeah, nobody else knew.
Right. Let me ask you quickly about the Vietnamization process. Based on what you witnessed in Southeast Asia over these couple of years, did you think that the South Vietnamese forces were capable of taking over that war and defending their country themselves?
Unequivocally, no.
Okay.
I thought it was an easy way for us to pull out and try to save face. I had no confidence whatsoever that they could pull this off.
Why is that?
They just, number one, the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, really didn't have a will to win this war. They really did not have the spirit to win it. And I also saw it come down from the top. I mean, all the way from the graft that was going on at the very top, it filtered its all the way down to these poor soldiers that we would encounter in the field. And these guys would have their families with them who were cooking meals for them. They had nothing. And whatever they had, part of their paycheck, went to the senior NCO above him, that NCO, part of his went to the officer above him, and et cetera, all the way up the ladder. So it was graft even within the military. And, I mean, these people didn't, I mean, they were conscripted. They had no will to go out and fight. Even though it was their war, I don't really, to this day, felt that they really, really cared one way or the other. There certainly was a group of people in South Vietnam that did, but they had no majority to back them up. Everybody, it seemed like, in the South was intent on making a dollar, and rather than having to fight the war, they'd rather have the Americans do it for them.
Do you think they had become dependent on the Americans, overly dependent?
Oh, absolutely, and you know, if they needed something, they'd have the Americans do it. They wouldn't do it themselves. And that's what I saw a lot of.
Okay.
If they needed a water plant, well, they'd have the Americans build it, and they wouldn't get involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was too much work. In the fighting, if they got into a bad firefight, it was better to retreat than to charge forward.
Right.
It was, they had really no will, and I found that the VC and, of course, the NVA felt that that was their country, and it was no North-South, it was Vietnam to them.
Do you think part of the problem might have been teaching democracy or trying to install capitalism and democracy in a country that really had no tradition of those two things?
I really don't know if I really think it came down to a philosophy of I don't think it, I mean, this could have been any kind of government. I just felt that the people of the North felt that this was part of their country. I don't know if it was if Ho Chi Minh had gone to socialism instead of communism, or if he'd gone to capitalism even. I don't know. I mean, that part of their country was theirs in their mind, and they wanted it. And there was a lot of people in the South that felt somewhat nationalistic as well. That country was part of the. There was no North and South. It was to be one Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we in the South, the capitalism. they sure found out how quickly they could make a buck, and they did. And I'm not saying that, you know, if I was in their shoes, I'd probably be doing the same, trying to do the same thing. But there was nobody left to really morally defend their own country, because nobody wanted to take that upon themselves to go out and put their own life on the line. They'd rather have the Americans put their life on the line.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and continue then with that?
All right. In this villa, we had the officers had a room on the bottom floor.
Mm-hmm.
The next floor, we had a big screening room, and I think we even built a little bar area up there. And then there were 1, 2, 3 bedrooms on the second floor. One bedroom was a single, and then we had two bedrooms, I think, that had two or three beds in each. And then on the next floor up, there was one large room, and then the NCO had his, that was in charge had his own room. Then we had a little rooftop up on top of that,
mm-hmm.
and a little balcony. But we had one fellow that lived with us that he was he'd have a few drinks, and he was wound a little tight about being in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if he'd been to Vietnam with another group before or what. But he slept with his M16 with the safety off and around in the chamber.
Really? In his bed?
In his bed.
Wow.
And his name was Akers. And he would have, if he had a little bit too much to drink, he would just say pass out or fall asleep in his bunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside, we always had, I mean, there were trucks backfiring all the time. Of course, everybody would jump.
Mm-hmm.
But while you were sleeping, and if they set off some fireworks or something, and a truck would backfire, he'd come just charging out of his room with his skivvies on, just screaming and running around with his M16. Where are they? Where are they? And all of us would just scream at him, hit the floor. And I said, God, I didn't know if I was going to ever get shot by the enemy or if I was going to get shot by Akers. But I had an M16 in my room.
Uh-huh.
At that time.
Right.
But I certainly didn't have a round in the chamber, or was it on the safety off?
That's pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, what did you guys do for recreation and entertainment?
Well, we had, that's excellent, because we had a little basketball court,
mm-hmm.
In our yard, and we had a nice front yard, and we had several dogs that we used to go out and play with and roughhouse with, and we also had the, I think we had a basketball game just about every night.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also played cards a lot, played poker.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of us learned how to play bridge over there. But poker was the main game. And we had a couple of officers that were really bad poker players.
Yes. So you invited them to play as often as possible.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, we had one poor guy that just, I mean, I don't know how much he lost, but his name was Brown, and he was probably one of the worst poker players I've ever seen in my life. And he lost a lot of money. But, well, we used to, everybody had their own. I can't remember what our policy was on alcohol, but I mean, we could have a drink. We could have some beers in the villa. That wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm. How about drug use?
You know, we had a few guys that would go up on the roof and smoke some pot.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody in our just about in our unit had smoked some pot at one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know when you would get it over there. They'd walk by our front gate, and you'd get a pack of Winstons or Marlboros that looked just like a pack of regular cigarettes, even with a filter on them.
Mm-hmm.
They had a factory pumping them out with grass.
Hmm.
And you'd just go up on the roof and smoke. And I think just about everybody in the unit, including some of the officers, partook in having a joint once in a while. But nobody, there was no one in our group that did any hard, what I called hard drugs,
mm-hmm.
or LSD or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have some occasional pot use, I guess.
Right.
Go up and smoke a joint up on the roof, mm-hmm. watch the firefight at night and the lights of Saigon. That
mm-hmm.
was about it. But it was amazing. It sure was very prevalent there. I
mm-hmm.
think you paid maybe a dollar or $2 for a pack of weed.
Wow.
And
I assume it did not get in the way of your job.
No.
Okay.
Even out in the field. Now, there may have been one or two guys that might have smoked a joint in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only think of one or two guys that possibly ever did that. But the guys that were serious, I mean, I'd say the majority of our guys in our unit were very, very serious about their work.
Mm-hmm.
We had some guys that drank considerably. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was they were in rougher shape than the guys that smoked dope at night.
Right.
I cannot think really of anybody that actually took some grass out in the field and smoked, except for possibly one or two guys in our unit.
Okay.
And again, when I was there through the end of 69, I knew of no one that was doing any hard drugs
mm-hmm.
at all.
Okay.
And I just can't think of anybody that would have been doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Concerning entertainment and recreation, mm-hmm. how about music? Did that play a part in your days?
Oh, yeah. We used to go to the library at Ponsonute,
mm-hmm.
and we all had, through the PX, we always had somebody in our unit would buy a brand new TQ or a Sansui tape recorder,
mm-hmm.
and we'd go over at, they had machines that we could record, do needle drops over there, you know, record off of music and put it on a reel, 7.5 inch, 7 IPS reel to reel, you know, player.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, that was the most sophisticated way to, you know, to play music.
Right.
We all had our own speakers, and somebody in the room always had a unit. I mean, like my first time over, I don't think I bought anything in Thailand, but when I got to Vietnam, I did buy some speakers and a amplifier and a tuner.
Okay.
And the next time over, I bought a reel to reel and possibly a turntable.
Mm-hmm. What songs come to mind when you think about those times?
Oh, I mean, I was recording the Beatles, the Doors, Mamas and the Papas, you know, mm-hmm. That type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much contact did you have with home?
Well, I had my uncle worked for the telephone company in Flint, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and he had something to do. He would occasionally get a phone call over to me in Vietnam,
uh-huh.
and patch in my parents.
Okay.
And that was maybe once or twice during my stay, the 3 or 4 month stay I had.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened, I think, on two stays when I was over there. It was letters from home and that type of thing. That's how we communicated, basically. I felt really fortunate to have those two.
Mm-hmm.
I know after I got hit, I was out of the country within several days after that. And when I got back to Hawaii, first phone call I made was, you know, to my parents to tell them everything. I said, you might be getting something from the Army saying I've been wounded,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't want to scare you. I said it was just a flesh wound, and, you know, I just wanted you to understand that, you know, I'm
mm-hmm.
okay.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I think that was the only other ways. Now, and again, you're asking about other entertainment. We'd go down to into Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and there were some great French restaurants that we would occasionally go to.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a weekly experience, but maybe once a month or three times, you know, three or four times while I was there, we'd go down and do that. Oh, the other funny thing that we would do for entertainment,
mm-hmm.
it was really fun. I mean, we'd go to the 5 o'clock Follies. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, a number of us would go down to the 5 o'clock Follies and sit in the back and laugh.
Why don't you go ahead and describe it for those listening who won't know what that is?
Oh, the 5 o'clock Follies was a daily briefing. I believe it was at the Rex Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the somebody telling the press about what went on in Vietnam for the last 24 hours.
Right.
And it was a press briefing. And a couple of officers would stand up and talk about all of the gains that we made, and the big thing then was body count. Now, give you an example. I mentioned earlier I flew with my uncle, and we lit up a bunker complex along a river in South Vietnam in the Delta, and I think there were five bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he actually had a little book that he could go to, after the F-104s went in and destroyed the bunker complex. Size of bunker, location of bunker, what the bunker looked like, he could tell exactly how many people were killed in there.
Wow.
And, of course, he had to put that in his in his report.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever there was combat or any type of action happening in Vietnam, there was an after-combat report sent somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so this after-combat report, be it from my uncle, who was a forward air controller, or from a captain that engaged the enemy with a tank squad, these reports would filter back as fast as they could to headquarters, MACV headquarters, and then that information was disseminated to this press conference at the Rex Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was laughable how many people, you know, how many people we supposedly killed every day. You know, the body count was such a big deal for the U.S. government. It was such an exaggerated account that nobody believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And how we were winning the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese was the other issue. And a lot of us, you know, if I'd been there my first time, I might have believed some of this. But after being there two times and traveling from one end of Vietnam to the other, I just thought it was pretty funny.
Do you think others in attendance, the press and the non-DASPO guys or everyone else, do you think they had the same feeling that this was laughable?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
There was, I don't know who they were trying to sell this to, but nobody was buying.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs didn't like the dog food.
Why do you think the government did that?
Oh, I think they did that to justify their position in Vietnam, either needing more troop strength or more equipment, more money, and this was their way of trying to let the American public know how the war was coming along.
Mm-hmm.
Now, be honest with you, even during Tet, in the second Tet offensive, we decimated the VC, and we certainly hurt the NVA very badly,
mm-hmm.
but we'd been telling, again, it goes back to the 5 o'clock follies, how they've been telling the American press how well we'd been doing and how, you know, how we had control of certain areas and everything else. They became their own worst enemy because their lies finally caught up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a turning point in the war. Not because we really, really battered the enemy, but the enemy showed that what we'd been telling them was certainly a bunch of BS.
Right.
And so this continued on. They never really, I don't think they ever really understood the marketing of the war, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with the press being able to go anywhere, not just being embedded with one unit,
mm-hmm.
They, if one unit wasn't doing anything, the press could jump from there and go somewhere else and actually, you know, verify what was happening.
Right.
So, again, we did have a good time going down there for a few laughs. Then we'd go to the Continental Hotel and have a couple of drinks and
mm-hmm.
Maybe head back to the villa and have a late dinner or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, I mean, I'm trying to think of any other things. We'd listen to music and, like I said, play cards and... you have to understand there was a lot of times we were out of the villa, and the times back were probably, I'd say we probably spent two-thirds of the time out of the villa.
Right. Okay. Did you keep up with news back in the United States?
The only way we could do that was Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, we got a biased paper there.
Right, right.
And... we really, but when I got back to Hawaii, see, I was able to, you know, catch right back up to where things were and,
mm-hmm.
and be able to compare. We really could get a grip and an understanding of what was going on
mm-hmm.
because we had AFVN and Armed Forces Vietnam Radio and Television,
mm-hmm.
Which we got, and we had the Stars and Stripes, and that was it.
Right.
But being able to go back to Hawaii as frequently as we did, we got a pretty real picture of what was happening in the world.
Right. Let me ask you more of a personal question. Did your spiritual beliefs change or alter any because of the war or during the war?
Oh, you know what? I think I became a fatalist.
Really?
A true fatalist, yeah. And it still carries over to this day.
Why did that happen?
Well, I think if my time was up over there, it was going to be up. And I certainly had a couple of incidences, not only in Vietnam, but the one I mentioned in Korea as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just became a true fatalist. And after seeing men killed, both Vietnamese and Americans, I really just said, if it's going to be, it's going to be. And I carried that all the way through.
Okay.
And as far as a belief in God, and I don't think that changed any as far as being able to say that I was more religious or prayed more in Vietnam than I do now.
Okay.
Probably not.
Okay. Could you make some comments on the enemy? Some general impressions of the NVA and VC, and then perhaps strengths and weaknesses of both?
Well, the enemy I think they wrote the book on guerrilla war. I mean, they were very, very hard to pin down to ever really actually fight with when it was our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
We fought them when it was their advantage. And I mean, they had the backing of the peasants, and if they didn't, they were brutal. They had no qualms about killing people to make them understand their point.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of things I thought about Vietnam. I felt that Vietnam one day would be a united country under communism. I felt that the South would probably corrupt the North someday. And I really felt that the enemy was, especially the NVA, they had a true belief. I mean, it was like, to me, I would say it was probably like our Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that was their country. I mean, how many men can you think of that would walk a bicycle hundreds and hundreds of miles and to carry just enough ammunition for several rounds to go out and turn around and go back and get some more?
Mm-hmm.
And they were tough. They wanted to win that war. And that inherent belief that they had carried over, and I think our failed policy was sending people back after 1 year.
Right.
I really feel that once we got to understand how to fight these guys, all the experience that we had gained left.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading We Were Soldiers once, when Hal Moore was right in the middle of the first biggest firefight, Westmoreland wanted him to be pulled out so he could just give Westmoreland a briefing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was typical. That was just typical. I really felt that guys like Westmoreland was a consummate politician. He wasn't a soldier. He didn't understand to get the grip on what was going on. And of course, he was influenced by politicians in our country as well.
Mm-hmm.
His hands were tied. And I think that went all the way down. That was just the wrong way to fight that war. And had we had the support like we did in Desert Storm and in this last conflict, where we could go after the enemy, I think it would have been a different story.
Do you think there was a crisis of leadership on the part of the United States in Vietnam?
Oh, there's no question. In my mind, there was.
Okay.
I mean, it was just a huge crisis in leadership, and it's like with any unit. I mean, even with our unit, we had some people that were so-called leaders. They were put into a leadership position and had no vision.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's the one thing that, they had no idea where we were going to go. They had no, plan for where do you want to see DASPO go now? And I think because of that is one of the reasons that DASPO collapsed. But getting back, I mean, the North Vietnamese soldiers were tough. They were very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know, I told you about my cousin. I went back down to the Delta quite a few times, and mm-hmm. I just enjoyed going down there and being with him and some of the Air Force guys. And I did that on my days off.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go down and shoot it and send the film off to Washington. I also filmed, and I've got it on some film that I'll be giving to Texas Tech that I had processed myself. There were several doctors down there that just gave of their time when they had any time off. They would do surgical procedures for the Vietnamese.
Hmm.
One woman had a clavicle that was shattered by shrapnel. And I filmed that operation. And actually, the doctor did the whole procedure himself. He had no help.
Hmm.
I think Bud, my cousin, helped him hold some instruments and hand him some instruments. And that was about it. But, you know, like I said, when we weren't typing captions, we were, you know, either playing basketball or poker and making runs to the commissary. And we hung out at the gate. there were always a few ladies coming by and asking us if we wanted anything besides marijuana.
Right.
And guys out there trying to sell dirty pictures of their sister and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a few of our guys that actually partook of these gals and fell in love with them even.
Really?
Yeah, I think that was maybe their first love of their life.
Hmm.
I think one or two even married a couple of gals that they met over there. Saigon was a pretty city. I mean, it really was in its day, it was really great. I mean, there was a lot of scars in it when I had gotten there, but
mm-hmm.
you could just tell by the way the streets were lined with the trees and the architecture. When you got down into downtown Saigon, it was it was very French. And I enjoyed going down there. I went down to the cathedral a few times, attended mass, and I enjoyed going down and just looking at the city. But I don't know, I never really felt comfortable with the people of Vietnam then. And I say then, because I've been back and I have a whole different feeling for them.
You want to describe that feeling? What has changed?
Oh, I think their philosophies have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're so-called, quote, under communist and socialism now, you talk about guys that are really hungry for work and willing to do anything now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just changed. It's a whole generation difference.
Mm-hmm.
It really was, the people there were very, very friendly and outgoing. And I think even some of the people that were carryovers from the war, it just didn't seem like there was any animosity towards Americans there at all.
Hmm.
I know we had a guide, and he said, you know, one of the reasons, he said, you know, we fought the Chinese for 300 years. He said, we fought you guys for approximately 25 years, and the French before you. He said, you guys were like a mosquito on a water buffalo compared to what we did with the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the differences, and I just felt very welcome. And I never felt that somebody was doing something behind my back,
mm-hmm.
as I did before.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember I was telling you about a couple of guys, we had a couple of other guys in our unit that we had two real wild men.
Mm-hmm.
One guy, his name was Dan Bauer.
Mm-hmm.
He convinced the doctors that he had a skin condition, and he got some kind of a deal where the doctors would let him have a beard.
Okay.
So Dan had this beard, and this Talmadge B. Harbison I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
grew his hair real long, and both these guys would sleep with hair nets at night, keep their hair down
mm-hmm.
when they'd get up in the morning. These two guys went out to the Big Red One, 1st Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
They would catch a ride out of Tansanute. And when we would take them out and drop them off, they would change out of their, I mean, their army, fatigues, the jungle fatigues, you know, all it had on there was DASPO and their name in black. So there really wasn't any recognition. But they would change out of those into a white T-shirt and a pair of bell-bottom pants, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they would jump on a plane with their cameras. Well, the two of them, and as the day went on, their hair got springier, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure they just kind of combed it out. And so they had this long hair, Bauer with his beard, white T-shirt, bell-bottom pants, are walking down the road into the Big Red One. And who comes by them is their the commanding general.
Mm.
And he has the driver turn around and swing back. He wanted to know who these two hippies were working for. What news organization would let these two hippies?
Mm-hmm. Did they say DASPO?
Well, they had to,
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the phone call went to Saigon our phone call went to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
The general's phone call went to Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And these two guys were kicked out of Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I said, you know, there's only about 500,000 other guys that would have liked to trade places with them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got Article 15s and busted a grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, geez, how many guys would have loved to have that happen to
mm-hmm.
them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an interesting story with
mm-hmm.
The guys in D.C. were climbing all over the major that was, I think it was Friend then, who was the major, and he just got just nailed by Washington. I'm sure he got ripped.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was passed on to a real nice guy that was first lieutenant who happened to be the officer in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, one of the last combat assignments I had was another search and destroy in I Corps
mm-hmm.
in November. Again, it was with the 101st Airborne near Cantien. And the mission was blowing up bunkers that had been spotted. And, I didn't know, how they were going to do this. And I just figured some C4 and that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were using sacks, like cement sacks.
Mm-hmm.
And these cement sacks were filled with tear gas. It was a powder, and they would take that in and then blow the bunkers. They'd detonate that with the C4. Well, every hole that through these tunnels, that stuff would seep through, and it would drift up in the air. Well, no one told me to bring a gas mask or anything on this
mm-hmm.
mission. I'm telling you, I had just... my eyes were running, snot was coming down my face, and I could hardly see, and I was moving away from this stuff coming out of these bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
What do I run into? A bramble bush, I mean, just ripped me apart,
mm-hmm.
and there were red ants all over it.
Oh, boy.
I said, the heat, the gear, the tear gas, the red ants. I said,
mm-hmm.
what a great day. But I think they blew up about 15 bunkers before we had to return to base camp, and we never ran into anyone on that assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Another one I had was back up into Phu Bai again,
mm-hmm.
and this was one of those great assignments where we went to an island about 10 miles off the coast of Hue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been reading about this group in the Stars and Stripes, and I went up to our CO and proposed that we do a shoot on this, and it was one Air Force man, a Marine CB, an Army guy, and a Navy guy. It was like four guys, and it might have been two of each. I'm not exactly sure. But they were there on this island to help rebuild the island infrastructure. And they would ask the village elders what they wanted to do. And he said, well, we need a bridge to get across this river, so it would really help it. Well, instead of them just giving them the money and watching it disappear, they actually bought the money with these people, the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese built the bridge.
Hmm.
I mean, they actually had them building things and doing things, and these guys were like really heroes to the people of this island. Mm-hmm. And I had a guy named Stu Barbie go with me on this. Stu had been, I think, about 6 weeks in a morgue. Mm-hmm. He was doing a job. They needed a training film on how we were identifying bodies. Mm-hmm. And Stu had been in there for 6 weeks doing this, and it was a gruesome job. So I said, I'd like to take Stu with me on this. And so the CO let us go. And Stu was so happy to get out of there. It really affected him. We had another guy, Bert Peterson, who spent weeks in there, and it never affected him. I mean, it was just a job. But Stu, it really bothered him. I mean, every night he had a light up on the roof and just smoked until he could finally fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And to this day, that Graves Registration Project still haunts him. Mm-hmm. But we left Saigon on this great day, and they took us. We got up to Wei. We choppered over to this island, and it was just a beautiful day. And they showed us what projects they had planned and what they were doing. And we said, well, we're going to stay up there for a week. And we were going to film, you know, where we were going to start and where was the sun coming up and that type of thing. And mm-hmm. So we figured that evening exactly where we were going to shoot. Well, the next morning we woke up and it was just raining cats and dogs. I mean, it was just, you know, a monsoon. And it rained for a straight week there. Mm-hmm. We never shot one frame of film.
Wow.
The entire time we were there. But we had a great rest and recreation for 1 week, and mm-hmm. it was one week I didn't have to go out into into the boonies and, mm-hmm. and film some other little combat operations, so mm-hmm. it wasn't too bad. I mean, these guys made homemade donuts every morning, and I caught up on, I think I read Lord of the Rings while I was up there.
Wow.
That was my last assignment Oh, one other interesting thing. The village priest decided to, you know, have us over for dinner one night. Mm-hmm. And it was a feast. But we got, being the guests of honor, they passed around this silver bowl mm-hmm. that had a top on it. And they passed it to us, and Stu and I opened up to eat it, and it was boiled chicken heads.
Okay.
And here you had a nice little old chicken head looking at you, and the idea was to pick it up by the beak, and, oh, God. After I got back, I came back to Saigon for 1 day, and then I left for Hong Kong.
Okay.
I got back, and I had to spend two more days there with Peter Friend, and he was then elevated to the commanding officer of DASPO PAC. Mm-hmm. And he told me at that point in time I needed to get a haircut.
Okay.
And which I did. I went out and got a haircut. I was just about ready to get out of the Army, and I'd come back from that, and I came back about 9 o'clock. He said, I thought I told you to get a haircut. And I said, oh, I did, sir. He says, well, you're going to get a better haircut when you get back to Hawaii. This guy was really an unusual person. When he was the OIC of the group before he became, you know, the commanding officer, mm-hmm. we had this little eating area. And the floor was like a tile, marble tile.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you would you'd move in your chair, the chair would squeak. Well, he just would go nuts and make the guys not move. I know on this last trip that he came in on, he screamed at us, and I think he even ate some of his meals in his room.
Wow.
But he had gone through the Army. He was an enlisted man to begin with, and he had gone through the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in the National Guard, he was made an officer. He was an enlisted man to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, other officers who knew him a heck of a lot better than I knew him said the guy had an inferiority complex,
mm-hmm.
big time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the officers that lived with him caught him one morning when he thought everybody was out of his shared apartment complex, saying over and over again, front of a mirror, why doesn't anybody like me?
Really?
Yeah. And well, he knew why guys didn't like him prior, the guys that were there prior to 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to do with Rick Ryan. But he really had a complex. And you know, before he came to Vietnam, he had gotten word that we were trading in huge amounts of grass. We were supposed to have tons of it in the
mm-hmm.
villa somehow. And one night we were watching a movie, and this Captain Richards, who was the CO over in Thailand, came barging into the villa unannounced.
Mm-hmm.
And he had us all come downstairs immediately at the dining room table, and he inspected the villa for the stash of grass. Of course, he went to the Connex containers. There was just nothing but tools in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went through everybody's lockers and drawers and everything. And I think he came up with one pack of grass. That's all he found. And later, we discovered that this was some theory that our new CO had concocted. But he was really directing it at one guy that he thought was a real hippie.
Mm-hmm.
And he really wanted to make an example of him after this thing happened with Dan Bauer and Harbison getting mm-hmm. busted. And he was going to make an example of this guy, but as it turned out, it was an illegal search, and nothing could have even happened to him. But I think our OIC, Bert Harris, was replaced because of that, and because of the two guys that were you know, busted for wearing those clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And another really good guy, Captain Ed McQuiston, was sent there, and he ended up getting screwed over by this major friend as well. But I know Captain Richards picked me up in Hawaii when I got back, and the first thing he said to me was that Major Friend had called him all the way from Saigon to inform him that he used to make sure I got a haircut when I got back as well.
Really?
Yeah, I said, wow, what a waste of money that is.
Hmm.
But, you know, guys that came in after me said that this guy had them washing and polishing the office floors in our office where we, you know, did all of our training.
Mm-hmm.
And they had civilian contractors that were doing that. And he just wanted to, you know, play Army. And I just also felt that, you know, this guy, he could have been Major Burns in MASH. The only difference was that Major Burns had a personality.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like he was tough. Or tough to exist with, I should
say. He wasn't tough. He just was a very odd guy. He'd always have the first sergeant do anything that was the dirty work. He never did anything. He would never confront anybody himself.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I really felt that he never really had a plan for DASPO and what we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he just became a real politician, and that's all it was. And we had some guys that came into DASPO that were looking for promotions as well, but had their own agenda, and it all hurt DASPO.
Mm-hmm.
But I sure enjoyed my time with it. I mean, it was really great. I mean, I couldn't wait to get back into college, but I was really focused on getting back to school, getting my degree, and looking forward to graduate school.
Mm-hmm. So why did you get out of the Army? Was it just you did your 2 years and that was it?
I was in three.
Okay.
I really enjoyed what I did. There's no question about it. But I mean, I really had after being in the Army and after being in college, I mean, I really couldn't wait to get back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was back there for 3 weeks after I got back from Hong Kong, 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, only thing for us to do was screen footage that was coming in and critique it. And I mean, we were, you know, really avoiding the office.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't wait to get out. And I wanted to get back to school.
Right.
And, I mean, the Army sure, even as great of a job I had in DASPO, I just couldn't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was with DASPO, I felt that I you know, I accomplished an awful lot. I had a lot of things on network news. I, as I mentioned, I was cinematographer of the year,
mm-hmm.
and I think I was nominated for that for six different times.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, but I really couldn't wait to take what I learned there and expound on it. And
mm-hmm.
that's what I saw I did. I left DASPO December 26th, 1969,
mm-hmm.
day after Christmas, and I was back in college in 10 days. I got out as an E5, and I look back at DASPO now, and I really didn't understand what a special group we were in, and
mm-hmm.
you know, in the history that we covered. I mean, I knew some of it, but I mean, it still really, you know, didn't realize it. I remember 10 years after I got out of DASPO, I was sitting at a airport bar waiting for my red eye flight back to Michigan, and
mm-hmm.
I was watching a show on TV. It may have been PBS, I'm not sure, but it was the 1,000 Day War.
Mm-hmm.
And what pops up was a whole bunch of scenes I had shot.
Really? You know,
I'm looking at this, I'm going, wow, what a strange feeling. I wanted to say, hey, that's something that I shot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think back then, you know, nobody would have really cared.
Right.
But, you know, it was interesting seeing that. I know, you know, we went to that our reunion this year
mm-hmm.
in Washington, D.C., 2002, in October. And we went to the 55th Combat Camera Group at Fort Meade in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And the cameramen in this group, they had the greatest gear you could possibly have. They even had satellite phones to get the problems out. But their chain of command, I couldn't believe it. I mean, that was one of the things that we were very fortunate with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could never be biased, and we could go anywhere we wanted. I mean, these guys were at a brigade level, and you know, they really had a hard time. Would have had a hard time getting around. Even you know, since Vietnam, other than this latest war, the press never really got a chance to go in the field like they did in Vietnam. The Gulf War coverage was limited. So was Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys were embedded, but they couldn't leave. Once they were embedded, they couldn't leave and go to another area. And I often wondered what happened with the 55th Combat Camera Company, how much they got to go and see and what they were directed to do,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have the flexibility or the power that we had. You know, I think DASPO, we did a great job covering the Vietnam War. You know, and when I talk to other veterans, I tell them about what we accomplished and what they did, and they still can't believe what we did. I mean, many of us, you know, we're still friends. We still can, you know, maintain really close relationships that were, 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we just enjoyed that.
That's a very special relationship you formed with these guys.
Yeah. Well, after I left DASPO, finished my degree at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
and then I got my master's degree there as well, and I taught some classes there. I taught a cinematography class, and I also taught an English class that was films adapted from novels, and I worked for 7 years as a producer of national commercials mm-hmm. back here in Detroit, and then I've owned my own production company for the last 23 years doing film and music production for just about every division of General Motors, Chrysler,
mm-hmm.
Nissan, Honda, and Acura, to name a few.
Okay.
And the last one of my accomplishments, I'm still on the board at Henry Ford Hospital, Heart and Vascular Institute,
mm-hmm.
and I chaired that for three of the years that I've been on the board.
Hmm.
So I've got three kids, and two still in college and one working in the advertising field.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of questions about,
sure.
In general questions about your experience in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, do you feel that you have experienced any disabilities or kind of PTSD type incidents since you left Southeast Asia?
None whatsoever. I think I had one dream maybe 12 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. That's the only dream I've ever had, any flashbacks, anything to do with Vietnam.
How did you deal with seeing so much death and destruction, especially the death of young American boys?
Well, I think it was just death of anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, our citizens is number one, but I guess I got very, very hardened and very, I'm trying to think of the correct word. I just, like I said, I became such a fatalist after seeing all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that it bothered me, and I still, you know, if I dwell on it, I guess it could bother me. Mm-hmm. But I've never stopped to really dwell on the death. I mean, I looked at it as a waste of our people,
mm-hmm.
And it was too bad that going back to I guess at the end of World War II, when we supported the French in colonizing Vietnam, and we went against the wishes of basically the UN.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really never realized much of this until after I got out of the Army and really started reading about the history of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and reading some of the books that had been written about Vietnam on how the politics worked and what was going on at the time.
So you did read about it and try to understand it more?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I still like to read books about Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And not just Vietnam, but all Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But Vietnam particularly still, you know, really interests me, and just to find out more and why we did what we did. I mean, I saved a lot of information about Vietnam, and because I like to read it. I like to go back and still see what things were said, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and see where things maybe possibly could have gone right and instead of going wrong. But I just became very hardened.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the United States could have done differently?
Could have done differently?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think it all goes back probably to 1945. Ho Chi Minh was certainly a socialist at the time. He had not really become a communist. And I really believe that Dean Acheson supported the French in keeping Vietnam and some of their other countries around there as a colony.
Mm-hmm.
And the French preyed on us to do that, and we decided to help them.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we would have changed course right then and there, things would have been different. But
okay.
Be that as it may, I think the politicians should have listened to the generals once we decided to go in,
mm-hmm.
put it that simply.
Okay. What were your impressions of the anti-war movement?
Well, at the time, I thought they were certainly wrong, but then after getting back to Hawaii and seeing what was going on in Vietnam, I think I think after a turning point in Vietnam, I think they probably helped shorten the war, believe it or not. I certainly didn't like at the beginning where they were doing things, but at the end, they had their right to make their protests, and I guess I still have some ambivalent feelings about what they did. I mean, you certainly are over there, and you'd certainly like to have some support.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really didn't like was when we came home from Vietnam and how we were, how I felt,
mm-hmm.
and how other, I think, men that served in Vietnam felt as well. There was no appreciation for what we did, what we tried to do.
How did you feel?
How did I feel personally?
Yes, sir.
I felt like a outcast. Not that people spit on me or anything else, but I felt that, he was in Vietnam. He must, you know, there's a stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that even in college when I got back.
Really?
Yeah. And some other people thought it was great knowing veterans, but I really felt there was a stigma.
Do you think the United States population has overcome that stigma, or do you think it's still...
Oh, I do. I think they did. I think they finally, after the first Gulf War,
mm-hmm.
I think that stigma was lifted,
okay.
and an appreciation was given for what the American veterans did during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember where you were April 75 when the country fell and how you felt then?
Yeah, I don't. I know I was back here in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and I knew it was falling, and you know, I watched helicopters pulling people off the embassy, and I felt horrible, horrible for the people that got left behind that we said that we were going to help. I thought that was just inconceivable that we didn't have a plan to get those people out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not surprised at all, and how fast it happened.
Mm-hmm.
No shock for me that it happened when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was happy to see that it was over with.
Okay.
And I felt no shame for our country, because I think our country did the best we possibly could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you think the war has most affected your life?
Well, it affected me because of what I did over there, positively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was able to take what I did and turn it into a position in life for me.
Mm-hmm.
As a cameraman. I started out as a cameraman, and I became I worked my way up to director and producer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's afforded me a very nice living style of living for my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it affected me in that way, and I also made some really terrific friends while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And those friendships, it's amazing how after all of these years, these friendships still continue.
Is there anything you would change about your experience in Southeast Asia if you could?
Yeah, I think now, knowing what I know now, I certainly would have done my job even better. I really would have. I mean, there's some things that I could have. I just said, God, I wish I had that. I wished I would have known that then, you know, and
mm-hmm.
been able to even enhance what we filmed and do other things over there
mm-hmm.
to show what the American soldiers were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I just would love to have a second chance to have that knowledge that I learned after Vietnam on filmmaking.
Right. Speaking of filmmaking, could you comment on the movies that have come out on Vietnam? Do you see these? And what's
sure.
your opinion?
Sure. First one that I saw was Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there really wasn't anything truthful about the movie if people were looking at that as how it really was.
Mm-hmm.
But it sure gave you a sense of the desperation of people. And that's what from a psychological standpoint, I thought it was a pretty good movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Deer Hunter was another psychological type of thing about stereotype again.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was really stereotyped, I thought, was Platoon. God, they threw everything in there they possibly could, from, you know, fragging to raping young girls to, I mean, it did go on, but
mm-hmm.
it certainly, they made it look like it was a common everyday experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that movie was a bit exaggerated. The last movie I can think of that I've seen on Vietnam was We Were Soldiers Once.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was fairly realistic, and but it still was Hollywood, and it could have even been more realistic, I thought, but it gave people a little bit of an idea of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably one of the best films I've seen since, you know, if you're going to talk about war, was probably the way Black Hawk Down was filmed. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it looked like it was filmed from a documentary standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that little incident wouldn't have even made it on the scope for what was going on in Vietnam.
Right.
I mean, that wouldn't have even been a blimp.
Have you seen the movie 84 Charlie Mopic?
No.
It's a Hollywood film, but it's supposedly a kind of a pseudo documentary of a government motion picture cameraman. Following around a squad in Vietnam. And I was wondering if you had seen it, if you could comment on it, but if not, then...
Geez, I never even heard of it.
You should check it out, see what you think.
I'm wondering where I can find that. I will.
It sounds like something similar to what the DASPO
guys
were
did.
Doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes,
I'd like to see that. And there was one other film that I was just going to comment on as well. Oh, gosh. I can't remember what it was.
Was it Full Metal Jacket?
Yes, that was it. Full
okay.
Metal Jacket.
Okay.
That was a pretty good film.
Mm-hmm. They did have some Daspo guys in there, didn't they? They had some film, some footage of American servicemen filming other
shooting
servicemen.
Shooting something, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, and that's basically. I mean, that film also was. I thought fairly well done, and it's certainly from an emotional standpoint, it gave a feeling of desperation in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Can you make some comments on the overall media coverage of the war? We talked a little bit about your experience with the civilian press
mm-hmm.
in country, but overall, looking at it, what do you think?
Well, for what they did, I thought they did a terrific job. Actually,
okay.
I mean, there were some guys there that ended up losing their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Covering that war, and men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you'd ever seen the book Requiem.
Yes, sir.
Well, I mean, there's a perfect example. These people were doing, what they thought, was the best job they could do, and they did it. I think the media basically did a fairly good job covering the war, although I do still think they were somewhat liberally biased in their reporting.
Mm-hmm.
But, looking at what the other side was doing as far as bias, I think it counteracted each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Army certainly, when I say the Army, the Department of Defense was certainly was being biased in Vietnam. MACV, they really, General Westmoreland's group, really slanted the news
mm-hmm.
and to their favor. And so I think... The press was slanting it the other way, and I think somewhere in between they kind of met.
Okay. If you had to talk to a group of young people today about Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
what would you tell them? I mean, to these guys, to this group of people, Vietnam's ancient history.
Oh, yeah.
What would you say to them?
Well, I would try to tell them a little bit about the history of Vietnam and talk about the French a little bit. Very little, because I didn't understand or read a great deal about all of the French involvement in it, and tell them about how the Gulf of Tonkin incident really got us involved in it, and
mm-hmm.
how the troops ramped up, and then tell them a little bit about my experience in it,
mm-hmm.
and I would basically talk about my experiences because those are the ones I really know the most.
Right. Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
No.
How many times have you been back to Vietnam?
Only once.
Do you want to go back anymore?
Absolutely. And I want to go back.
Really?
Yep. Yes.
What would you do?
Well, I want to go to some other places besides Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I want to experience some of the other areas. I really would, and I also would like to get a little flavor of the North.
Mm-hmm.
I understand Hanoi is doing gangbusters. I know when we were in South Vietnam in Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City, but everybody there still calls it Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I was aghast that nothing has really happened. I mean, there really has been in the years. I mean, I look at Bangkok, for example, and Bangkok looks a little bit like what Hong Kong looks like, with towering skyscrapers everywhere,
mm-hmm.
huge amounts of commerce. And then I look at Saigon, and there has been hardly any new building there, and the free trade is not happening there. And these people want to work and make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And the old guard, and they're still the old guard until they die. I don't think anything's much going to happen there. And I still think they're punishing the South Vietnamese as well from the North, because Hanoi is pretty much booming.
Mm-hmm.
From what people tell me,
mm-hmm.
and these are people that I trust because they're CNN people that have been both places, and they're saying Hanoi is a great town and lots of industry there,
mm-hmm.
but not much in the South.
Have you ever been to the memorial in Washington D.C.?
Yes.
What was your experience like there?
I worried about it for years. I avoided it like the plague.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to go there.
Why?
I just afraid I was going to have an emotional breakdown. Mm-hmm. Seeing the, you know, one of my best friend's name on the wall. I really felt that I just didn't want to be around anybody when I went there. I just can't tell you how apprehensive I was. And I did go. Mm-hmm. And I was glad that we went with our reunion group, and I'm glad we did. And there was a lot of emotional support there.
Mm-hmm.
I just dreaded going there. And if we hadn't had that reunion there, I probably wouldn't have gone. First reunion that we had was in D.C., and I actually was working on a job, and I could not get there. And I wasn't unhappy that I couldn't go, because mm-hmm. I dreaded going to the wall and seeing not just Rick's name, but 50,000 other names there.
Right.
It's very dramatic. It's a very quiet, dramatic spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think the design of that, it was just phenomenal.
Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversations we've had the past 2 days?
I think that's enough, don't you?
I don't know if it's ever enough.
Yeah. I'm sure there's 20 million other things I could think of at some other time, but
right.
At least you get a kind of a flavor of where of my experience in DASPO and,
absolutely.
And in the Army in Vietnam.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I hope it helps.
It does. Let me go ahead and sign off. This will end the interview with Mr. Theodore Acheson. Thank you very much, sir.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey.